WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Folklore is probably the oldest subject matter on the face of the earth. We have no people on the face of the earth for whom we don't have folklore. The first thing people does when it gets a written language is to record its folklore. So we have Sumerian proverbs and so on, or myths from different peoples. But the subject, the scientific study of it, is relatively recent. Now, one of the problems about being a folklorist is, besides the fact that nobody's heard of it as a field, which makes it tough to get jobs, is the word folklore itself as an item of folk speech. When somebody says to you, that's folklore, usually they say that's just folklore, which is worse. It's equivalent to that's a myth or that's an old wives' tale. What in fact does it mean when somebody says that's folklore? It means it's a mistake, it's an error, it's a fallacy, it's not true. So if folklore is error, what am I doing and what is Bob doing with a PhD in it, teaching it in a university framework, offering courses in it, and so on? Well, this of course is not what folklore means to the folklorist. Folklore to the folklorist means something quite different. This is a little bit about what I want to say before giving you some examples of it in our own society. We can divide the word folklore into folk and lore to understand it. So, who are the folk? In the 19th century, it was thought that the folk were peasants. The folk were thought to be the illiterate in a literate society, people who couldn't read or write in a society that had reading or writing. And sure enough, the Grimms, whose name surely you know, when they went to collect folklore, went to the illiterate, unlettered peasants, and these people did know tales and songs and proverbs and riddles and so on. So there's no reason to doubt the theory. It was only relatively recently that we've come to realize that this notion of folk is inadequate. Not that peasants aren't folk, they are, but we have redefined folk. And the reason I mention this history is because, again, in terms of the difficulties of doing work, particularly field work, when you go out to collect folklore, if you go to somebody who lives in a city and say, I'm here to collect folklore, they're insulted. Or other people say, why are you coming to me for folklore? I have a college degree, or I'm a teacher, or I can read and write, and so on. The people are very indignant that you're asking them for folklore because they have this 19th century notion of the folk as uneducated. We define folk in this way now. The folk are any group of people whatsoever who share at least one common linking factor. And it doesn't matter what the common linking factor is. It could be common geography, so the people of a particular state. That would be the folklore of Delaware, or the folklore of the United States, as opposed to the folklore of Canada, the folklore of Mexico, the folklore of England, whatever. Each little town, each village, will have its own traditions, particularly true in Europe, for example, where each little town has its own costume, and as you move from one area to another, you see the differences in costume. You can almost, it's like a line that crosses. All of a sudden, they're appearing in different costumes. So there will be regional or city or village traditions. That's a folk. But the thing in common could be common occupation. So each occupation has its own traditions. So we can talk about the folklore of cowboys or coal miners or whatever. It could be common religion, so that there's the folklore of Mormons, Catholics, so on. Also folklore about these groups, and we'll get to that a little bit later. So could be common religion, common ethnicity, each person belongs to an ethnic group, an occupational group. In fact, the concept of folk, as folklorists use it now, is so flexible that it can range all the way from a country or nation, so we can talk about American folklore, for example, or English folklore, French folklore, all the way down to a family. Because, after all, a family is also a group of people who share at least one common linking factor. So there's such a thing as family folklore, and all of you in this room have family folklore. You may not have thought of yourself as a member of a folk group quite in terms of family, but all of you have traditions that you have learned by being born into a particular family. It's kind of interesting. When somebody marries, you immediately get exposed to the other family's folklore, and you don't know what it is the first time you run into it. You have to kind of become acculturated. For example, how many of you here have expressions in your family, probably negative and pejorative in nature, which, using somebody's name, the person may not know that they are the subject of folklore. It'll be like, don't pull an Uncle Joe, or don't be an Aunt Tilly. Can I see hands of those who have such a thing? Where did you learn that? Did you go to the library and check out a book? No. You learn folklore the way all people learn folklore, whether it's family folklore or the folklore of a country, from other people. It's passed on from person to person. And this is one of the characteristics of folklore as opposed to other kinds of transmission, like learning it from just from a written tradition or from books. All right, how many of you have a family whistle? For example, when you're separated in the parking lot or in the supermarket and so on, and you're trying to get everybody, let me see hands of who has a family whistle. Yeah. How's it go? Well, mine was. Now, one of the things you find out when you're in the department store, ready to go home and trying to figure out where sister, brother, mother, father, whoever is there, when you do this traditional family whistle, it's only known in your family, is you give the whistle and 10 people are ready to go home with you. That's your first clue that this may not be unique. And this is one of the things that we find in the study of folklore, is that things which people consider are only American, or only in Delaware, or only among coal miners, or only among whatever group, the family, by the folklorists knowing about the comparative tools of folklore, we find that many of these things are found, not universal. I don't think any folklore which is universal. Universal is all peoples have folklore, yes, but not the same tales, not the same songs, and so on. Most people, when they talk about universals, are really talking about Western man. You know, if Europe has it, well, then that means everybody has it. Of course, not so. Most of the things that we talk about in the Indo-European world are missing, for example, in the rest of the world. For example, the evil eye, which I've done research on for a couple of years, it's Indo-European and Semitic, very widespread, even in this country, among Italian-Americans, Greek-Americans, and so on, but not found in North and South America, not found in Australia, New Guinea, Sub-Saharan Africa. In other words, you know, 8/10 of the peoples of the world don't have it, so it's not universal. One of the things we do in folklore is study the universality or the lack of it, really, or the distribution of a particular item of folklore. So I hope you can realize, in terms of our definition of folk, that we are all in this room members of at least one folk group. As a matter of fact, we're members of more than one folk group, and that brings up the whole question of code switching, because when you move from your religious group to the military reserve group to the camp reunion group to whatever, as we move around, and the academic community is also a folk, you share certain traditions by being at a particular school, because they'll have local traditions about graduation, fraternities, or sororities, or athletics, or whatever. As we move from one group to another, we code switch. And you have to learn how to do that. You can't tell the Marine or the Navy or the Army jokes at the church social, because this will be frowned. And there are even jokes about it in the military, about how to pass the salt down, for example. So you can see from this that we're much more flexible than in our conception of folk. And that means that to be a folklorist, you don't have to go out in the countryside to the boondocks, boondock being a Tagalog word from the Philippines, meaning a remote mountain fastness. We shorten it in California to the boonies. I don't know whether they use it here on the East Coast or not. Actually, in California, we also call it the tules because of the tule fog and the tule reeds. There are surely what we call blason populaire, or traditions about other areas, the rural. Usually it's the rural that doesn't, is not up to date with the urban. This is interesting in terms even of North and South stereotypes. In many of these countries, you have the Southern Italians, the Southern French, the Southern Germans versus the Prussians, and so on. Even in the United States, the stereotype, except in the Southern Hemisphere, it's the other way around. In Brazil, it's the Northerners who are the lazy. Same kind of folklore, but it's reversed. In any case, we know that all of us have these kinds of traditions. And that's why to be a folklorist, you can be a folklorist anywhere in the world. You don't need a big laboratory. All you need are live people, whether they're from your own group or not. So that's so much for folk. I hope it's clear who the folk are and that you all of us in this room are folk and members of many different folk groups. We are, in effect, part-time folk because we are, we belong to many different communities. Now, what about the lore part of folklore? What's that? Well, the lore consists of a number of genres or forms or types of traditions. Some of these genres are what we call the major genres. For example, epic, or myth, or folktale, or legend. Now, epic, for example, just to give you one example. When I was in school, I was taught somehow, or I got the impression that the epic was one of three or four pieces of literature. That is, it was Beowulf, Aeneid, the Iliad, the Odyssey. I thought that's what an epic was. I had no idea, as an undergraduate, because I never even heard of folklore until after I had a graduate degree in something else, that epic was a live form, sung or chanted today, right now, in Yugoslavia, in East Africa, in China, India. One's in Yugoslavia up to 13,000 lines. It's not a literary form particularly at all. It's obviously an oral form. It's a folklore form. And this brings it to another important point about folklore. Most of our great, we have this elitist bias in education. You know, you're educated if you, have read the great music and the great art and the great literature. You can graduate, in other words, from major institutions without ever having heard of folklore. And yet, it's folklore which is the source of so much of literature, art, and music. Half the Canterbury Tales are demonstrable tale types. Bela Bartok was a student of folk music long before he was a composer, and so was Kodály, and so was Vaughan Williams. I'm doing a study now of Bruegel's painting, the Netherlandish Proverbs, where he took proverbs and translated the verbal into visual, and you have visual puns involving verbal materials. So you can't study great art, great music, and so on without it. In any case, the epic is not a literary form. None of the folklore materials are literary forms, though literature may be derived from it, but it's not to be confused with it. So epic would be one form of folklore, and folklorists may specialize in just one form, epic, or maybe just, you know, East African epic or India, epics of India. So there's epic, there's myth, there's folktale, there's legend, there's proverb, a riddle, tongue twister, curses, charms, all different kinds of folk songs, ballads, lullabies, work songs. All there are hundreds of different folk kinds of folk songs. Games, for example. Think of all the children's games there are in the world. Hundreds and hundreds of games. Gestures, there's another form. Jokes. Think of all the jokes in the world. All the slang or folk speech or folk art or folk medicine. Again, there are, let's say, 200 or 300 forms of folklore, and there are people who are specialists just in superstition, just in folk medicine. There's so much work to be done in this field of folklore, and yet so few of us really carrying it on. As I say, we used to hold our national meetings in the phone booth. Now we're about, 300 or 400, and we've almost gotten to the point where we don't recognize all the faces. But this is essentially the way we conceive of folklore. You would go to a folk group, whether it was a family or an academic group, whether it's sociologists or philosophers, if you want. Whatever group you're working with, you would then try to elicit items of folklore, proverbs or folk speech or jokes and so on. And so we go around with our tape recorders and our notebooks recording the folklore. Now, the point of it all is, okay, so it's a separate discipline, I believe it, and you go around and collect folklore from folk. Why? To what purpose? What do we learn from folklore? And this is really what I want to talk to you about. Because folklore is a kind of mirror of the culture. It's kind of autobiographical ethnography. It's what a people says about themselves. There may be distortion, all right, in the way a people perceives itself, but at least it's distortion introduced by the people themselves rather than the a priori notions that the sociologists, the psychologists, the political scientists, whoever, come to when they do their research. Folklore goes there to find out what the people are saying, how they perceive themselves. It is a way of looking at a culture, in short, from the inside out instead of the outside in. And this makes it a really unique kind of material to work with. Now, the thing we're interested in, then, is to collect folklore, not just classify it, though folklorists do plenty of that. We have tale-type numbers and ballad numbers, and so Cinderella's tale-type 510B and Barbara Allen is child and ballad number 84 and so on. We do that. We classify it. But the most important is we try to understand it. What does it mean? Why are people telling this tale, singing this song, telling this proverb? That's hard. Meaning's always hard in all these fields. In effect, the field of folklore is like having all of English literature without English literary criticism, if such a thing. I mean, that may be good, actually, but or any of these literatures. In other words, we have all this wonderful material, all these volume upon volume of superstitions and proverbs, you see, and myths. We don't know what they mean. Even the American Indian, we have all these American Indian myths, but nobody thought of asking people what they thought they meant. And that brings up the question of whether people, in fact, know what they mean. And I think that's a real problem. I think much of folklore is passed on from one person's unconscious to another person's unconscious, and people don't ever think about it. It seems so trivial. It's like the fish being in water. The fish doesn't know it's in water until maybe it's removed. Now, I want to illustrate for you by taking some examples of folklore in the modern world to analyze it, or suggest at least one kind of analysis for you, to show you the way in which the folklore in the modern world works. And there are dozens of examples I could use. One of my favorites is the folklore of what do you do when you're a child and your tooth comes out? Put it under the pillow. How many people put it under the pillow? Is there anybody here that puts it in a glass of water? Uh-huh. Where are you from, glass of water? New Jersey? With that water, you put it... Yeah, well, where is your family from? Are going back as many generations as necessary. Before they were Americans, what were they? Irish, perhaps. Well, it's found in some parts of Europe and in Australia and Switzerland. Where is our other glass of water? Yes, where are you from? England and Ireland again. Well, there might be... That's why when we collect folk, we ask this kind of question, because these certain traditions will come from a certain area. I remember asking once this question, and somebody said... They were from Minnesota, I guess, or one of the Dakotas, and said, not only did they have the glass of water, but the water had they put salt in the water. which I had never run into before. Again, when you collect folklore, that's the beauty. That's why it's different from written materials. When you take a book out of the library, every time you read that Faulkner novel, that Shakespeare play, same thing. Yeah, the scholars will argue over folio this and the thee should be changed to the, but basically it's always the same every time you check it. It'll be the same 100 years from now when you check that novel out. Folklore is never the same. It's always the same and never the same. That is, yeah, I know that. It's every time you've heard a joke or played a game, you say, yeah, I know that, but the way we used to do it, you know you're in the presence of real folklore because it has multiple existence and it shows variation. Anyway, in this one case, they had the glass of water that had salt, and I couldn't figure that out. And I said, where are you from? They were from Norway, the parents. It's clear that the water that was used was probably taken from the fjord, and it was salt water. And what's interesting about the nature of tradition was that here in the middle of North Dakota, wherever it was, it had to be done right. That is, you had to put the salt in it. All right. In either case, whether it's in the glass of water or whether it's under the pillow, what happens? Next morning, you had a quarter. And who does this wonderful deed? Let me see the hands of the tooth fairy. Hands for tooth fairy. How many, are there any good fairies among you? Are there any mice among you? No mice? There's a mouse. Good. I'm glad. You never know. You see, I never know what's going to happen. Where are you from? And you, Ukrainian descendants. So Ukrainians have mice. Actually, the mouse is much more common than any of these, the tooth fairy and good fairy, which probably comes in part from England. And throughout Latin America, it's a mouse. You know, once I was talking to someone from Vermont, and they said that in their house, it was a fairy mouse. Obviously a transitional figure. And in the next morning, under the pillow were raisins. At least that's what she said. The point here is that with folklore, you're always going to get variation. And it's interesting to collect the variation because the variation may often tell you about the particular people and their values and their worldview and their ideology. And that's why we're interested always in collecting variants. In any case, just to finish this off, the next morning, as I say, in the glass or under the pillow or whatever, whoever brings it, good fairy, tooth fairy, mouse, what do we have? Money, yeah. What was the ante when you were a child? You said a quarter. Actually, my day it wasn't a quarter, I hate to say. A penny? Where is who? A penny? My goodness. You were robbed, you people. Go back to your parents, just go get them. Actually, you can't get by for a quarter these days, I don't think. What is it now? Half dollar. Going once, going twice. Do I hear? Yeah. The point is there'll be variation. If you needed an index of inflation, just in case you didn't know, you could do a study of the ante. And also there'll be variation as to how the tooth comes out, whether it has a cavity in it. There are all kinds of other possible variations in this particular custom. Now, all right, here's a typical folklore custom, and you could just see it out of the library, you know, interesting tooth customs around the world and so on. The point is, what does it mean? Why do we do this? What is the child being taught? In order to do a study of folklore, you have to be comparative. It's not enough to know how it is from your informant or even from your whole culture if you're looking at the wider context. You have to know how the custom is done elsewhere to see what is unique. You don't know what's unique you see from your informant or from your culture until you know how it is elsewhere. If you look at this tooth business around the world, first place we have a universal in the sense that the loss of the first dentition is universal. And that's a biological given, clear. But how the culture responds to that universal is going to be different. That's where we have the culture of relativism. So in most parts of the world, the whole idea is simply to get rid of the tooth. You throw it away. The American Indians do. They just throw it over the chiquilla, as a Florida Seminole informant told me. Reason? You don't want the tooth to fall into the wrong hands. If a person who was hostile to your family or to you got hold of the tooth or a lock of your hair or your name or a piece of your clothing, they can work magic against you through standard principles of sympathetic magic. In the mouse tradition in Europe, for example, in German folklore, there's a little rhyme which could be translated essentially, mouse, mouse, come out of your house. What you do is you put the tooth down on the floor next to a mouse hole. You remember the farms or the way the things are built, you have, first of all, you have mice around or you have connected to the animals stable. So, mouse, you put the tooth on the ground, mouse, mouse, come out of your house. And what you want is the mouse to come out and take the tooth away with the hope that the new tooth that grows in will be as sharp, as incisive as the tooth of a mouse, which is believed to have a very sharp tooth. Knowing this, that the majority of people are simply concerned with getting rid of the tooth so it won't fall into an enemy magician's hands, or that you want to have a sharp tooth to grow in, there should be something about the American version of this custom that kind of leaps out at you. What is the child being taught? Putting it a little crudely, to sell his body. I mean, It's under the pillow in the bedroom. You got to go in the middle of the night and make this change if you're either a tooth fairy or a good fairy or whatever you are. And it's a payoff. It's a little payola. And I've had kids tell me they lived in this chinchy one penny. I can't believe it. I never heard one penny. Delaware must really be... But anyway, where they lived in that cheap one penny thing, and they wouldn't turn it in their house. They go down the street to their friend's house where it's a dollar, and they split 50 cents apiece. Is that un-American? No, I don't think so. Of course, you're also compensating the child for the loss of a body part, which is surely somewhat traumatic. But my point is that it isn't just a harmless custom. It is reflecting American ideology and values, you see. It's not just something, oh, well, you know, just a little harmless custom. Where, after all, do you find Santa Claus around this time of the year? Where do you find him? Where does he hang out? In the shopping centers, right? In the department, hey, come in our, you know, buy this and buy that. And so on. The kids are dragged, literally sometimes screaming, to this strange Santa Claus to tell them their fondest desire because the parents want to find out what the kid really wants or whatever. It's a babysitting thing for childcare for whatever. In any case, the point is that Santa Claus it hangs out in the department stores. Is it un-American? No. Although there are concerns that we should put the Christ back in Christmas and make it a religious holiday, the fact is that it's no surprise to the folklorists that the festival, which is another genre or type of folklore, reflects the values now you can deplore it, you can say, I don't like these values, but don't blame the folklore for the values of the society. All the folklore is simply providing the mirror. It's like, you know, it's like destroying the mirror because you don't like the ugly reflection you see in it every morning when you step in front of it. So, there are people who want to do this. There are people who want to ban folklore. As we find in communist countries, they try to specifically alter the folklore to make it serve a certain propagandistic viewpoint. This is a very common thing we find in Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union, and particularly in China. Now, one of the main things that when we start looking at it is... folklore is, again, how much of the folklore you have to know to understand the culture around you. Let me give you a couple of examples. You remember the television program Get Smart? It was Agent 99 was the woman, and Agent 86 was Maxwell Smart, all right? Question, why is he Agent 86? You 86-something, that's barroom slang. I don't know how you happen to know that. But 86, when you're 86'd, you're thrown out of a bar. Also, it's also used in short order slang, where if you work as a waitress or waiter in a restaurant and the cook is telling you not to take any more orders of the pea soup, he'll put in the blackboard in the kitchen, you know, pea soup 86, meaning out of it. Out of it. So Maxwell Smart is agent out of it. It's clear as a folklorist that this was not accidental. In other words, it's clear that that's the reason why the number was chosen. You are missing. You don't understand this kind of play if you don't know the folklore. Let me give you another example. Ken Kesey wrote this best-selling novel, which was then later made into quite a handsome movie. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Right? Where's that come from? In order to do a study of folklore, whether it's folklore in culture or folklore in literature, you have to first identify it before you can interpret it. And the problem in general in folklore is you have literary scholars or anthropologists who interpret and they can't identify it. On the other hand, to be fair, the folklorists identify it and they never interpret it. What we need is somebody who can do both, whether it's literary scholars or social scientists who are willing to take the time to identify folklore properly in terms of the standard scholarship, or folklorists with a little more imagination who are willing to interpret. In any case, let's look at that. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. When do you say one flew east, one flew west, one flew over the cuckoo's nest? It's like one potato, two potato, or eeny, meeny. When do you say those things? When you're counting out. Thank you. That is exactly what it's called. It's a counting out rhyme. Before you start playing, one flew east, one flew west, you know, it's like my mother told me to, you know, all this, you know, what color was this, all those things. There are hundreds of those counting out rhymes. What is the function of a counting out rhyme? In order to choose it, what do you have to do to the other people? You have to eliminate them. Now, what is the setting of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? A mental institution. And what kind of people do you find in a mental institution? People who have been eliminated, counted out, and so on. Clearly, plus also the association of cuckoo, or at least when I was a kid, you used to, you know, play this, either you did it, whatever. So you have to know, it's clear that the title of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is not picked at random. This is a title which, like a T.S. Eliot's objective correlative, the theory of which is that a poet picks an image in which is supposed to evoke in the listener or the reader or the viewer of the painting some kind of image. The problem, of course, in Eliot's own execution of his objective correlative philosophy is you got to have another book to read at the same time to tell you what you're supposed to think when you read this particular image. But folklore doesn't work that way normally because these things are around. They're in tradition. They're a counting out rhyme. They're a piece of barroom slang which gives you the possibility of seeing this. All right. It's not that simple, though, to simply go around and ask people always what folklore means, because people can't tell you. And this is where we get into the unconscious, and this makes it difficult. And let me give you some examples. What do you put on the back of newlyweds' cars after they're married? Tin cans or old shoes? All right. So if you see, and how many of you actually seen old shoes at one time in your life on the back of the bumper? All right. What do they mean? Why do you do that? Point is that people do not know why they do what they do. It's simply, well, that's what we did when old so-and-so got married. I mean, that's just what you do. I mean, that's the custom. That's the tradition. People do not try to consciously analyze their own folklore. And yet, as I'm trying to tell you, this is what the folklorist is trying to do, to look at these things which we take for granted. And in effect, it's what people take for granted that can often give you the greatest insight. You see, it's like looking at the water that the fish are swimming around in. All right, so what about this, putting the shoes in the back of the newlyweds? What's this connection with shoes and marriage? Remember the story, the famous folk tale of Tale Type 510B, for those who are in the initiate, about Arna Thompson Tale Types. Anyway, Cinderella. How does Cinderella find the perfect mate? The shoe business. It's even glass, which is interesting. Now, again, when you approach folklore, you can have two points of view. You can say it's literal or historical or psychological or symbolic. And you can do this with the flood myth. Either there was a literal flood, which, of course, is part of certain religious groups' belief system, and may have been, of course, an actual flood, or it may have been simply an analogy with the nature of human birth, since all humans are born from floods of amniotic fluid, of course. And so as the individual is created, so the world could have been created in the same way. And, of course, the literal and the symbolic, or the historical and the psychological, are not mutually exclusive. There may have been an actual flood, and one of the reasons why the story diffused as widely as it did is because of the imagined similarity to the nature of human birth. By the way, it's not universal. It seems to be largely absent in sub-Saharan Africa. But to come back to the shoe business, you know, do people really get married on the basis of running around with glass slippers and so on? In most cases, you see, what we're dealing with in folklore is fantasy, collective fantasy. And so it's not literally true. And we can come back to this other rhyme, because again, the interesting thing about folklore, like all culture, you break off a little piece of the culture, and the patterning in the little piece is going to be the same as the patterning in the whole. So you could start anywhere. And of course, you could never end in your analysis of folklore until you've asked every question about the culture and written a complete ethnography, a complete description. But in any case, the shoe symbol is not going to be either universal. There are some people who don't have shoes, certainly don't have glass slippers. But on the other hand, in American culture, and in this case European culture, there will be a consistency of the symbolic use of shoes. So there was an old woman who lived full time in a shoe. What happened to this old woman who lived full time in a shoe? She had so many children, she didn't know what to do. Now, what possible connection could there be between a woman who lives full time in a shoe and having all these children? It just doesn't make any sense. It's not easy to make sense of nonsense, to find a rationale for the irrational, to make the unconscious conscious. You're going to tell me what the connection is. But why should a shoe be a sign of fertility? You just put your foot in at that time. On the other hand, if the shoe fits. We have a verse in the Ozarks in the 1890s, which helps a little bit. There was another old woman who lived in a shoe. She didn't have any children. She knew what to do. A little bit closer. Now you're saying, well, you're just picking certain rhymes. Well, not really. Cock-a-doodle-doo. My dame has lost her shoe. A real challenge for the transplant people. And it goes on. Her master's lost his fiddling stick. They don't know what to do. These are sad, really. In any case, I'm not interpreting. I'm simply reading these rhymes to you, realize. Now, the point is that there's a consistency here, it seems to me, in the symbolism of the shoe. But I think some of this is going to be unconscious. I think people use these materials. They'll say they're historical. Nursery rhymes reflect political events of the 18th century. So there are all these wonderful theories. Anything to deny the possibility that these things are fantastic. Let me give you another example. Let's take jump rope rhymes. That's harmless, after all. Fudge, fudge. Tell the judge. Anybody know this one? Mama's got a brand new baby. It ain't no boy. It ain't no girl. Just a plain old ordinary baby. What do you do with it? Wrap it up in tissue paper, throw it down the elevator, first floor, second floor, third floor, right? Nice little rhyme. Or
There's another one. I had a baby brother. His name was Sonny Jim. I put him in the bathtub to see if he could swim. He drank up all the water, ate up all the soap. He tried to eat the bathtub, wouldn't go down his throat. He died last night with a bubble in his throat or whatever. Okay, nice little rhyme. Nice little rhyme. I mean, what are we talking about here? Actually, any lesson in literature that you want to teach, whether it's metaphor or plot or rhyme and so on, you can teach from folk literature. Because folk literature is earlier. That's what drives me crazy about the people in literary departments who look down at folklore, at this vulgar, trivial material. If I take 100 people walking down the street of this town, and I ask them how many of them can sing Meistersinger all the way through, or how many of them have read Finnegan's Wake twice, I don't know how far I'd get, even in a college town. But if I were to ask these same people how many have ever heard of Pat and Mike, or the old woman who lived in a shoe, I'd bat almost 100 out of 100. And yet we have all these courses in literature and humor and Mark Twain and metaphor and Chaucer and so on, and so few people studying the oral literature, the traditions, the customs, the beliefs of the peoples of the world. Anyway, let me come back to my I had a baby. Look at the tense of the verb, and I had a baby brother. I had a baby brother. Tells you something right there. What do we got? We got wishful thinking here. We've got sibling rivalry. Now, let's just do these two rhymes just quickly to show you the way this works. I had a baby brother and so on, name was Sanjay. Put him in the bath to see if he could swim. Now, is this really a scientific experiment? Is a girl who's old enough to jump rope really saying, I don't really know what's going to happen when I put this kid in the bathtub to see if he could swim? And why the bathtub? Why not throw him down the elevator like the other kid in the other rhyme? Why the bathtub? My point about the analysis of folklore is that if it's there, it's there for a reason. Not that we always know the reason, and it's hard to analyze the reasons, but it's there for a reason. Why the bathtub? What happens when the kid old enough to jump rope says, okay, Mommy, I'd like some help with my homework now, or can you play with me now? Can I show you my project for school? And Mommy says, well, I'd love to, but now I got to do what? Give baby a bath. All right, so I'm going to give baby a bath this time. And then what does the baby do in the tub? He drinks up all the water and so he tries to eat the bathtub. Again, irrational behavior. Makes no sense at all. Why should the baby do this? Now, Mommy, you gave baby the bath. Now can you help me with the homework and the new math and help me with the quiz and so on? No, now I got to do what? Got to feed him. How many meals a day does this baby get? How many do we get normally a day? Three. That's the ritual number in our American culture. Not just the three in folklore, the three wishes of the three brothers, the three sisters, the third time's a charm, and so on. Because the categories we find in folklore are also the categories of the whole culture. It's good, better, best. It's first, second, third person. It's in our language. It's in our kinship system. It's parent, grandparent, great-grandparent, then great-great. You have to repeat. You can only go to the limit. The limit is three. Three is the limit. Eternity actually comes from Trinity. It's the same three. We have the God, the Father, Son, Holy Ghost. We have the networks. All the names in American culture are three parts. You see, the whole culture is three determined. Normally, it's B.A. and M.A. and Ph.D. It's the ABCs. It's, you know, reading, writing, arithmetic. I mean, a whole culture is based on a three determined notion. And even science turns out, you know, they divide the world this way with North, Middle, and South America. All the world, the intestines and all this stuff is. And then you have the DPT shot or the polio series of three shots, you see. This is where it's very interesting because science, for all its supposed objectivity, turns out to be a folk category in disguise. And that's one of the important things about folklore. Once you recognize the folklore patterning, like I say, it's the piece of the culture you break off, it then gives you an insight. And of course, it's not universal. All peoples have number symbolism, but it's not the same number. American Indians have four. So there'll be four brothers. In China, it's five, usually. It's interesting, when American Indians tell tales to Europeans, they'll often cut off one of the repetitions because they know that we can't stand. I mean, we don't even know we're here. It's like, go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody the gray goose is dead. I mean, we don't even, John Brown's body lies emoldering in the grave, John Brown's body lies emoldering, John Brown's body lies emoldering, you know, row your boat. I mean, you know, it's totally unconscious, but there it is. The patterning is absolutely consistent. Now let me come back to this thing about the feeding the baby. So the point is we have three meals a day, usually with, you know, three plates and the three implements and all the rest of it, and rare, medium, and well done. So in the whole business. So the point is the baby is getting more than its three square, right, a day. And so from the point of view of the older child, what kind of an appetite does this baby have? An insatiable appetite. And so what is perfectly, it is poetic justice for this little baby in the bathtub, eat everything inside, to kill itself basically by overeating. Now, again, are you going to ask this little kid who's jumping rope, what are you going to ask him? How do you feel about your baby brother or sister? What kind of an answer are you going to get? You see, that's the beauty of folklore. You ask direct questions about politics, about siblings, about parents, about religion, about sex life, and so on. What are you going to get? Oh, I can't tell you that, or what do you want to know, and so on. People won't tell you, but they'll tell you their folklore. They'll tell you their proverbs and their jokes and their riddles and their customs, and they don't realize how much of themselves they're telling you. And that's, again, the beauty of it, because it is this unconscious mirror of a society. Let's go back to the other rhyme for a minute, again, to show you. Fudge, fudge, remember, tell the judge, mama's got a brand new baby. What's that about? Again, sibling rivalry, clearly, you're getting rid of this baby brother. But why fudge? Why fudge? Again, is fudge universal? Do all peoples in the face of the earth have fudge? No. You don't find it among the Australian Aborigines or the peoples of New Guinea or so on. Not universal, but we've got it. We're stuck with it if we're folklorists. What are we going to do with it? What does this fudge mean? Now, what would a linguist say? Fudge, fudge, tell the judge. Rhymes. Clearly, rhymes. That doesn't tell you all you need to know, unfortunately, about this particular example. But what does fudge mean? Again, can we ask the informant? We should always ask the informant, what does fudge mean? Well, I don't know, just that's the way it is, just like with the shoes in the back of the newlyweds' cars, you see. But fortunately, again, in folklore, you have consistency of the patterning. So there's another rhyme. I wonder if any of you know it. It goes, milk, milk, lemonade, what's the rest of it? Around the corner, fudge is made. How many of you know that rhyme? Let me just see hands. Oh, see? Bunch of nasty kids here. All right. Now, my point here is this is not something that I am reading into the data. You see? It is very explicit what fudge is with these accompanying gestures, with you placing your hands for milk, milk, and lemonade, and around the corner fudge is made. Now, let's go back to that other rhyme. Fudge, fudge, tell the judge. And this newborn baby, what do you do with this newborn baby? You wrap it up in what? Yeah, but not in all versions is it tissue paper. Toilet paper. Anybody actually heard of toilet paper or not? Where were you when I needed you? Yes, okay. Wrap it up in toilet paper. Now, what sense does this make? Fudge, fudge, and wrapping it up in toilet paper. This is crazy. Think back, if you can, in the days before sex education was taught in kindergarten. Way back. When a child was told that there's a baby brother or sister to be. I always tell you, it's going to be great. You're going to have a little baby brother to play with and so on, and it's going to be wonderful. And then they can empirically see this, the sort of where it's located. And if they don't see initially, they eventually do see. What do they assume? How does the baby-to-be make its exit from this area of the abdomen? Well, it makes its exit from where all things, as far as the child is concerned, makes the exit. And the exit is where? It's the anus, clearly. Now, the point is that what we have here is a folk congruence here with psychiatric theory, because it's a standard psychiatric theory that this is how young children, at least at one time, thought that the people were brought into the world. Now, again, I don't think you can ask the informant to tell you what fudge is or what it means, because I think it's really serving on an unconscious level. Now, the unconscious content need not always be sexual. Let me give you an example. Anybody in here know the story of the wide-mouthed frog? What are the animals involved? Don't remember? Usually, often it's a giraffe, mama giraffe. What do you feed your baby? They feed them leaves from the top of the trees. Oh, is it so? No. Oh, is that so? That's right. Yeah, and then I'm a wide-mouthed frog, mama hippopotamus. What do you feed your babies? I feed them mud from the swamp bottom. Oh, is that so? And then mama alligator, I'm a wide-mouthed frog. What do you feed your babies? I feed them wide-mouthed frogs. Ooh, is it so? All right. I started collecting this around 1970, 71. And as far as I know, it doesn't go back much earlier than that. Question, why, what does that mean? Why are people telling this? Again, you could say, well, it's just because it's funny, or it's a piece of whimsy, or I liked it. That's not a good reason. Why is it funny? Why is it amusing? And why did it come into existence around the 1970s? There are historical questions as well as psychological questions. But they're hard to get. I had no idea what it meant at all until one day I was lecturing to a group of, I think, eighth graders from a high school not far from Fremont, California, about a half an hour from Berkeley. And after I'd given a little presentation of folklore, I said to the kids, well, any of you have any folklore you want to share, tell us. Oh, so one girl says, I know a story of wide-mouthed frogs. And fortunately, as a folklorist, you see, normally if you were literary trained, you say, oh, well, I already know that story. I don't need to get that. But the folklorist always is interested in yet another version, because you're going to get that fairy mouse, or you're going to get that special new clue, perhaps, to unlock the whole thing. So the girl told the following story. There's a wide-mouthed frog in her kitchen, and she hears a great commotion outside. And so she goes outside to investigate and says, what's happening? Somebody says, oh, they're hanging wide-mouthed frogs. She says, ooh, I didn't know. Now, when I heard that text of that wide-mouthed frog, I understood, or had a clue anyway,
about who the wide-mouthed frog might be. What's happening in the second story? What's going on out there? A lynching, that's right. And who is being lynched? Wide-mouthed frogs. In American history, who was lynched by whom? Blacks by whites. Now think back. In American minstrelsy, when whites were actually acting out being blacks, what do they do? What's the first thing they did, practically? Made wide mouths. And you have the whole, you know, don't nigger lip the cigarette. You have all this stereotype of the big lips, the wide mouth. And what, in fact, is the thing about? You have a wide-mouthed frog who has to learn to speak differently to survive, right? And what are we arguing? Well, what happened in the 70s with not only busing and integration and the whole bicultural thing, and blacks have to learn to speak white? Although, curiously enough, whites enjoy speaking black, and they're not allowed to do it. If I'm right about this thing, when you ask somebody to tell the story, they will actually use dialect. When they say, what do you feed your babies? In fact, the way it's beautifully constructed linguistically to force the protrusion of the lips. And in fact, if you listen carefully when somebody tells a story, that's why I don't like to tell it myself, because I'm influenced, obviously, and biased by my own theory. But the idea would be that they'll actually be using white stereotype of black dialect when they tell this thing. You can check this out by asking. But it is that, what do you feed your babies? Mom, hippopotamus. Even when the frog says, what's happening? I mean, that itself is black. I mean, again, there were all these clues in it, you see. And again, the stereotype is there. Imagine a frog, I mean, or any animal that doesn't know how to take care of its own babies. Is that part of the stereotype? The people on welfare, the people, you know, whatever it is, the people are giving inadequate support for their own. I mean, the whole stereotype is right there. And of course, the irony is that the other animals, if they're hippopotamuses and alligators, really do have wide mouths. But they don't count because they speak properly. It's only the wide-mouthed frog who is supposed to deny its own identity, as though that were possible, simply through a change in speech. Actually, when it's ooh, I didn't know, in fact, it's hypercorrect, because people who say ooh, except around this area maybe, or it's actually the Chesapeake, I think, except anywhere else in the country, when you say ooh, it's people who are putting on airs. It's hypercorrection, in fact. My point again is, assuming I'm right for the sake of argument, I don't think people are aware of this consciously. I think they simply tell this as a way of dealing with. I mean, why do they suddenly make King Kong? Remake King Kong in the same period. Where does King Kong come from? Yeah, that's that kind of animal. Although not actually in the novel. Where do we associate King Kong from? Jungles of where? Africa. And what is the famous scene, at least of the first version of King Kong? The one sort of indelible scene that's always shown in the clips and so on. What happens in that King Kong? Well, he runs off with screaming Fay Wray up to the top of this building. This tall, tall building. As far as tall buildings go, you know, what is George Washington, the father of our country? What kind of a monument? And what do they say about George Washington up and down the East Coast? Not that he visited here or that he ate here, but he slept here, yeah. Well, if he's the father of our country. But point is that even architecture has these symbolic associations. My point is, and this is interesting, historians hate folklore because folklore is error in that notion I said before. Therefore, if you are a good historian, to the extent you've weeded folklore out, all the stories about George Washington, they say these are apocryphal, they're not true. My point as a folklorist is, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. I mean, if it's true, that's fine. We're not necessarily opposed to things that are true. But what's important is what people say. You see, it's what folk history is important, whether it's true or not. And you can often tell more about a people from what they say happened than, in fact, what really happened. As far as that goes, just because it's written down in some document doesn't mean that it's true anyway. Though the historians have this tremendous bias in terms of what's written, you see. Let me just move for just a second, because I'm going to run out of time here, I can see. Out of folklore for one second into popular culture. I really shouldn't, because I have so much about folklore I want to say, but it seems to me popular culture is also part of our world. If you want to divide the world into three, just for the sake of argument, you have high art, high music, and so on. Then you have popular culture. This is the comic strips and movies and the westerns and television and so on. And then folklore. They're somewhat different because of the case, the Peanuts, for example, is a comic strip, is not folklore. It's the same. Every time you read that particular strip or you see this Charlie Brown special, it's the same. There's no variation. We know who wrote it. Most of the cases of folklore, we don't know who wrote these things. I mean, Woody Guthrie wrote hundreds of songs, but only one or two became folk songs. That is sung actually by the folk. So Long It's Been Good to Know You, or This Land Is Your Land, and so on. All the other songs he wrote, as far as I can tell, never really made it. Because it's really hard to create a new folk song or a new joke or a new proverb. Just try it. My point, though, is that popular culture is also around us, and we are much influenced by it. In some sense, it substitutes for some of the things that folklore used to. I just want to give you an example of how the same kind of analysis would obtain in analyzing popular culture. Let's do Star Trek, just to show you. Now, this is obviously popular culture, not folklore. I want to make that clear, perfectly clear, I should say. Now, it's about, of course, a ship. I assume everybody's familiar with Star Trek. And you have the ship going, visiting these other worlds. And when they go visiting the other worlds, are they invited to visit them? No. They suddenly just sort of appear uninvited, as a folklorist and anthropologist does. You know, I got my grant. I'm here to do research. And invariably, when they arrive on the scene of visiting these other worlds and peoples, these other peoples are in some kind of messed up situation. Often, actually, the ship itself is in peril. And you see them, you know, they're in a force field and so on. They're shaking around. So what is the name of the ship? Enterprise. Yeah, okay. So the Enterprise is being shaken around and jarred and so on. They've got to do something about those people down there. Now, there are several possibilities. In some cases, when you beam down all that, you can reason with them. You can give them a little democracy, like, you know, why don't you put a secret ballot in, or bring in rights for this minority group, whatever. You can fix them up, and democracy will work wonders, or religion, or some combination thereof. On the other hand, sometimes these people are really messed up, and they do not respond to a number of doses of democracy or Christianity, whatever it is. Then what do you have to do? You've got to zap them, and you got to get rid of them, and so on. Remember, that's just like in Vietnam. Remember, we had to destroy the village to save it? Remember that piece of wonderful reasoning? Well, now, the point is that when these decisions are made to either convert or kill, who actually makes these? Who's in charge of this ship? Captain who? Kirk. Ah, nice name. What does that mean, Kirk? What's Scottish for church? How convenient. Now, who are the other top people in the ship? Spock, although he has somewhat of a breeding problem. Basically, it's, again, a German-Irish name. I mean, Spock is not a foreign name, after all. And who are the other leaders, the engineer and the doctor? Who are those? What are those people's names? Scotty and McCoy. Terrific. Now, when Kirk and Spock and all these gang decide, you know, come right to course so-and-so or open fire and so on, who actually turns the wheel? Who actually pulls the trigger? Does Kirk actually do this himself? Well, who does the work? Well, it's Sulu and Uhura, and they've got a whole ethnic support group there to actually carry it out. Now, once you have converted or knocked off this alien culture down there, this, of course, sets free the ship. And so you have free, what's the name of the ship? No, that's American. That's American. Or you take something like Star Wars, which, again, is popular culture, but what's interesting as a folklorist, just as the Canterbury Tales, half of which are folk tales, or just as I tried to show you in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Star Wars is based on folklore. Clearly, it's a folk tale. You have the hero with foster parents. You have the donor figure with the weapon of the father being, you fall in love not with the piece of the lock of hair, And so on. Here it's a modern technological, you know, the little image pops out, right, with the message. But it's basically a standard folk tale in terms of the quest, of the villains, and so on. But that's not enough, because I'm not sure folklore can really play in Peoria or whatever. So you have to put, on top of Star Wars, you put an overlay. You put World War II films. Because who are the enemy? Who are these people? How are they dressed? They're Germans. They're stormtroopers. I mean, they even call themselves storm. And they're up in Valhalla plotting the end of the world and so on. So you have these Germans. You have, in terms of this whole paradigm, of course, you have one other enemy group, and it's that wonderful bar scene where the pilot, the mercenary pilot, is supposed to pay off his debts, and there's a little figure comes around, short and green, I guess. And that one's interesting because that particular enemy doesn't speak our language. You have to have subtitles. Remember that? That's interesting, subtitles. Now, what could that be? What language does that sound like? I'm told, actually, it's Nahuatl. But what does it sound like to our untutored ears, most of us? What kind of language would it be? You can guess. It's Japanese, surely, that it needs subtitles for it. So you have the little green people who are trying to collect the debts, and then the big German stormtroopers. And, of course, the war wasn't fought just by Americans alone. You have the little ally there. 3PO, no? Isn't it 3PO? Well, but the one with the accent is 3PO. What kind of an accent is that? British, effete, you know, speaks all these languages. Not quite a man, but
you know. But a good ally, you want them on your side, you see. Well, anyway, never mind the folktale underpinnings. Never mind the World War II films. That's not enough either to play in Peoria to make a smash success. You've got to have something else. You've got to have a little symbolism here. Because how, in fact, does the hero succeed in destroying the arch-villain? First of all, you got to handle what? His father's... What is that thing? Yeah, the light beam. What is it called? What's the name of that? May the what be with you? The force. Uh-huh. Yeah. What kind of force? Well, what shape is it in? I mean, you got to learn to handle it. And he has a terrible time when he's first learning to handle his father's life force. Remember, it keeps getting away from him, and he can't. And eventually he has to close his eyes and trust his feelings. Another nice little piece of pop-site. Remember that? And when does he do that? What is the actual task to be accomplished here? How does he actually destroy the enemy? He's going down that narrow little canal. He's got to drop it right down in the little hole, right? And then... You knock off the enemy and you get the girl, almost. Although that's a little hip, too, because liberated women don't want to be passive, rescued heroines anymore. Well, I want to close by giving you, and there's so many more things I would like to tell you. All this ethnic material. I mean, even the fact that we have a Polish pope now. It's incredible that people need to have, through ethnocentrism, some other group. You see, some other group to make fun of. I think part of the whole appeal of the Polish cycle was because it took the heat off the blacks. It wasn't couth anymore to tell them about the blacks, and so he had to find some other group that wouldn't fight back, probably because they weren't smart enough. No. So there was this whole Polish cycle, and some of these are very interesting, not just the ones where the Polacks are foolish and so on. Some of them are very interesting. And again, the beautiful commentaries that folklore makes about our society. For example, do you know how Poland would have handled the Vietnam War? Same way we did. That's nice. In any case, these ethnic things are extremely interesting in terms of the stereotypes. And you can say, I don't like stereotypes, I don't like racism, but, you know, take a look at the ad for flesh-colored Band-Aids. I mean, we're not even aware of the racism. We're not even aware of the racism, but yet it's there. It's like in the Wide-Mouth Frog, even the Sesame Street, Kermit the Frog sings, it's not so easy to be green, isn't it? Yeah, that is to say, to be colored. Go look at your unabridged dictionaries when you get home. Anything white, even a lie, is okay. On the other hand, blackguard, blackmail, all the words of blame. I mean, it's in our whole symbolism of the, you know, Jack Palance on the black horse. This whole symbolism, and of course it's not universal. Color symbolism is not universal because if you got married in white in China, you'd be dead. I mean, because white is the color of death. What do you get married in China? Red. That's why all the Chinese restaurants are red. I mean, they have color symbolism like they have number symbolism, but it's not the same. It's not universal. We need to know these so you don't offend people, because half of the offense in the world is like the evil eye. In our culture, you're supposed to praise people. You know, it's a nice-looking baby. It's a nice-looking dress. Where'd you get it? You say this in a culture that has the evil eye, and you say that's a beautiful dress, or it's a beautiful shirt, what will they do? They'll give it to you, because they're afraid of the evil eye. You would never praise a baby, because you would give it the evil eye, and the baby might get sick and die. So it's not enough. You have to know what the other culture is, what the other culture's folklore is, or you can do terrible things. You mean, well, gee, all I said was you have a beautiful baby. Why do you make me spit on it, you see? Because you have to undo, you have to use an apotropaic prophylactic gesture to undo the damage. So there's an applied aspect to folklore. It's not just fun and games. It's not just interesting because it tells us something about the world we live in. It's crucial because we have to deal with other peoples. We no longer live in a society where we're only talking to ourselves, basically. We're talking to other peoples. We're trying to negotiate. And it turns out the shape of the table is important. You see? Who would have thought that the shape of the table could make any difference? But all this stuff is unconscious. And that's what we're trying to do, is to try and make the unconscious conscious so we can better deal with the world. Now, I'll end with a couple of examples of academic folklore. And I'm interested now in a kind of folklore which is folklore of offices and bureaucracy. The book is called Work Hard and You Shall Be Rewarded. It's urban folklore from the paperwork empire. And I had trouble with some of my colleagues because it isn't oral. And they say, well, if it's not oral, it's not folklore. But I think that's a mistake. It's like, you know, Murphy's Laws. If anything can go wrong, it will. And there are a whole series of other laws. Patrick's theorem, if the experiment works, you must be using the wrong equipment. Allen's axiom, when all else fails, read the instructions. Or the futility factor, no experiment is ever a complete failure, can always serve as a bad example. And so on. What we have here is the whole scientific worldview, which suggests that error, if it's codified, as long as it's codified, you see, it counts. I mean, if you can codify it. Just give you a couple of examples of academic folklore. There's a wonderful one which academics might enjoy. It's called A Key to Scientific Research Literature. And what it is, it's hard to do. These never exist orally. They're passed around the office of Bilderberg. You have these things passed around. There's Xerox, and there's two columns, what he said and what he meant. So what he said, it has long been known that means, I haven't bothered to look up the original reference, but of great theoretical and practical importance, interesting to me. While it has not been possible to provide definite answers to these questions, the experiment didn't work out, but I figured I could at least get a publication out of it. The operant conditioning technique was chosen to study the problem. The fellow in the next lab already had the equipment set up. Three of the S's were chosen for detailed study. The results in the others didn't make sense. Typical results are shown. The best results are shown. Agreement with the predicted curve is excellent, fair, good, poor, satisfactory, doubtful, fair, imaginary. It is suggested that, it is believed that, it may be that, I think. It is generally believed that, a couple other guys think so too. It is clear that much additional work will be required before a complete understanding. I don't understand it. Unfortunately, a quantitative theory to account for these results has not been formulated. I can't think of any, there's anyone else. Correct within an order of magnitude. Wrong. Thanks are due to Joe Klotz for assistance with the experiment and John Doe for valuable discussion. Klotz did the work and Doe explained what it meant. Now, those people who are in academe maybe can recognize some of those features. Now, last two examples. First, I want to give you the college girl's letter home. Some of you will know this. And here again, in the way in which folklore functions, if you were to ask a middle-class WASP parent their fears for their precious daughter as she goes off to the big college university for 4 years, you couldn't get a better and more encapsulated version of the anxieties of middle-class parents in the following letter. Dear mother and dad, it has been 3 months. Here's our three again. It has been 3 months since I left for college. I've been remiss in writing. I'm very sorry for my thoughtlessness and not having written before. I'll bring you up to date now, but before you read on, please sit down. You are not to read any further unless you're sitting down, okay? Well, then I'm getting along pretty well now. The skull fracture and the concussion I got when I jumped out of the window of my dormitory when it caught fire shortly after my arrival are pretty well healed by now. I only spent 2 weeks in the hospital, and now I can see almost normally and only get those headaches once a day. Fortunately, the fire in my dormitory and my jump was witnessed by an attendant at the gas station near the dorm, and he was the one who called the fire department and the ambulance. He also visited me at the hospital, and since I had nowhere to live because of the burnt-out dormitory, he was kind enough to invite me to share his apartment with him. It's really a basement room, but it's kind of cute. He's a very fine boy, and we've fallen deeply in love and are planning to get married. We haven't set the exact date yet, but it will be before my pregnancy begins to show. Yes, Mother and Dad, I'm pregnant. I know how very much you're looking forward to being grandparents. And I know you'll welcome the baby and give it the same love and devotion and tender care you gave me when I was a child. The reason for the delay in our marriage is that my boyfriend has some minor infection, which prevents us from passing our premarital blood tests, and I carelessly caught it from him. This will soon clear up with the penicillin injections I'm now taking daily. I know you will welcome him into the family with open arms. He is kind, and although not well-educated, he is ambitious. Although he's of a different race and religion than ours, I know that your oft-expressed tolerance will not permit you to be bothered by the fact that his skin color is somewhat darker than ours. I am sure you will love him as I do. His family background is good, too, for I'm told his father is an important gun bearer in the village in Africa from which he comes. Now that I brought you up to date, I want to tell you there was no dormitory fire. I did not have a concussion or skull fracture. I was not in the hospital. I'm not pregnant. I'm not engaged. I do not have syphilis, and there's no Negro in my life. However, I am getting a D in sociology and an F in science, and I want you to see these marks in the proper perspective. I mean, I think that more or less does it for fears of parents, and also it tells you something about the emphasis on grades. I mean, after all, that's part of it, too. Here again, you see, this apparent folklore, which is, again, trivial. You see it on offices and so on. It doesn't mean anything. It means a great deal. First place, you can't have humor without tragedy. There's no such thing as having comedy without underlying tragedy. And that's what we have to remember. It's the same coin, just looking at it from both sides. And this is what we have to realize. And again, it's so obvious. And when folklorists are busy writing this stuff and collecting, people say, oh, everybody knows that. Why are you writing that down? Why are you looking at that, you see? Everybody knows. Of course, everybody doesn't know that. In any case, even if they do, that's fine. We want to show what is, in fact, common. What do people take for granted? Last example, because I'm running way over. And this is really going to help you. This is tremendously useful, I hope. This is a final exam. After all, now that I've told you about the lack of importance of grades, now I'm going to give you a final exam. And this is so terrific. On a half a sheet of paper, it gives not one final exam, but all the final exams in all the subjects of the university. I mean, this is a tremendous document when you think about how much knowledge is compressed into this. And so you can pick out your own major here, and this will really help you as time goes on and knowing the final. I won't read all of them, actually, because it would take too long. I'll just give you a couple of samples. Instructions. Read each question carefully. Answer all questions. Time limit, 4 hours. Begin immediately. Now, here's the final exam for history. I think it's a parody, but you'll have to listen. Describe the history of the papacy, from its origins to the present day, concentration especially but not exclusively on its social, political, economic, religious, and philosophical impact on Europe, Asia, America, and Africa. Be brief, concise, and specific. Final exam in public speaking. 2,500 riot-crazed students are storming the classrooms. Calm them. You may use any ancient language except Latin or Greek. Final exam in medicine. You have been provided with a razor blade, a piece of gauze, and a bottle of alcohol. Remove your appendix. Do not suture until your work has been inspected. You have 15 minutes. Final exam in music. Write a piano concerto. Orchestrate and perform it with flute and drum. You will find a piano under your seat. Final exam in biology. Create life. Estimate the differences in subsequent human culture. If this form of life had developed 500 million years earlier, with special attention to its probable effect on the English parliamentary system, prove your thesis. Final exam in sociology. Estimate the sociological problems which might accompany the end of the world. Construct an experiment to test your theory. Final exam in political science. It's quite similar, actually. There's a red telephone on the desk beside you. Start World War III. Report at length on its socio-political effects, if any. Final exam in philosophy. Sketch the development of human thought. Estimate its significance. Compare with the development of any other kind of thought. And finally, the final exam in astronomy. Describe the universe and give two examples. Thank you very much for your attention.